Good morning. We're going to be looking at a passage from Mark chapter 3 today. This is a story about a confrontation between Jesus and the Pharisees, and this takes place on the Sabbath. And so normally when people kind of preach on this topic, it's usually about the Sabbath. We're not going to be talking a lot about the Sabbath today. That's not the direction I want to go with it this morning. But here is this story as it begins to unfold. It says in verse 1 of Mark chapter 3 that he entered again, talking about Jesus, he entered again into the synagogue, and a man was there whose hand was withered, and they were watching him to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath so that they might accuse him. So this is the way the story is set up, is that Jesus is coming to the synagogue, which was his custom, which implies that the Pharisees knew he was coming. There is a man in the room who has a withered hand. We don't know if the Pharisees set this up or if they just knew that guy was always there too. And so Jesus would likely see this guy. We're not really sure. Some people believe that this was set up. Others believe that this was just the Pharisees being aware that they would both be in the same place at the same time. Regardless of which, it is not really overly germane to the story. But we know that this man is there, Jesus is there, and the Pharisees are watching. Now, this is critical. They were watching him to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath so that they might accuse him. Right. How many people in this room are older than 30? Okay. That tells me two things. Number one, most of you are going to appreciate what I'm getting ready to say. And number two, you guys need to do a better job of inviting people. Okay. All right. I am very fortunate. I'm 53. I turn 54 next month, and I am very fortunate because most of my poor behavior as a child is simply locked in the minds of people who saw it and not on film. Not on film. Jenny's clapping because Jenny is older than 30. Jenny, most of her stuff, not on film. I weep for teenagers in this world who have every stupid thing they do on somebody's phone. And a lot of that stuff makes it to the cloud, and a lot of that stuff makes it to the internet, and you have to live with that stupidity for the rest of your life. And you go, oh, no. See, nobody will remember that. Well, I'll get to that in a minute. So here's the thing. We live in a world today where we are constantly being watched. I didn't say surveilled, but I will tell you that the other night, Dad and I and Stephanie were having supper. We were having supper with Clea and Laura, and we were sitting there, and Dad and I and Stephanie had been talking earlier in the day about a cousin of mine who lives in Greenville. We were talking, Dad had said something about maybe giving her a call, and he was trying to get together and have lunch. We didn't get to make that happen. But that night I get on Facebook and it shows me people you may know. And there was her name. And I went, they're watching us. They're watching us. Stephanie and I have talked about stuff that she wanted to buy, and then like the next day, she'll open something and there'll be an ad on whatever thing she opens, and there's an ad for that thing that we were talking about. Because the Google is always watching. And if you have Alexa, Alexa is short for Alexios, which is a Russian name, because they're watching you. But I digress. We live in a world where people are always watching. People are always watching. And I think maybe Jesus understanding what the future would be like maybe lets this story happen so we would appreciate this story even more, because this is a story about Jesus going into a place where they're watching him and he knows they're watching him. He knows they're watching. Now, how many of you would say that your behavior is different when you know someone's watching you? Now, behavior, it's really interesting. Sometimes we're better when people are watching. Sometimes we're not. I had a friend years ago who in practice was one of the best ball players that ever lived when nobody was watching and nobody cared. But when you got in the game and people were watching and there was pressure, oh, poor fella. Some of you can appreciate that, so especially those of you who played ball or any of you who have coached. You're like, oh, yeah, I got a guy like that. I know a guy like that. I was that guy. And if you don't believe it, you go in a gym. I used to go in a gym and shoot free throws, and I could shoot free throws, and I'd make 9 out of 10. And then I'd play in a game, and I'd make 6 out of 10. Because nerves would get to you. So understand that we live in a world where people watch us, and that should affect how we act and how we behave because our social media is watching us and people with phones are watching us and, you know, that people are always watching us. And it's not just that stuff is recorded. That's not even the point. The point is we're being watched. And this is, as a Christian, something we should always be aware of, is that people are watching us. And it's not a question of why they're watching. It's just a question that they are watching. Because people are watching us, that should impact the way we act, because we are witnesses, we are people who are giving a testimony through our lives for our relationship with Jesus. And so people are constantly watching that, and they're watching to see what we do. And so in this text, Jesus has walked in, and he comes in, and there's this guy who needs healing. And the Pharisees are watching because it's the Sabbath, and they know it's the Sabbath. And so we get to verse 3. It says, he said to the man with the withered hand, get up and come forward. And you know the Pharisees are going, oh, we got him now. We got him now. And it says he said to them, so he turns to look at the Pharisees, and he asks this question. Is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath? To save a life or to kill? But they kept silent. Okay. Now, there is a significance in this question that I think if you just kind of glance at it, it seems like, well, that's kind of a random question. Now, notice they keep silent. Why don't they answer? Is the answer to that question not obvious? Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath? Now, the answer is yes. The answer is yes. It is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Everybody knew that. In another interaction with the Pharisees about the Sabbath, Jesus actually says, look, if your ox fell in the ditch on the Sabbath, wouldn't you get him out? And they were like, well, yeah, of course we would. So the answer to this question should be obvious, right? So why don't the Pharisees answer? And the reason is there is a really intricate beauty to this question, because Jesus does not simply say, is it okay to do good on the Sabbath? Now, do any of you in this room believe Jesus was thinking about killing this guy? Okay, so why does he say, is it lawful to do good or to do harm? If Jesus isn't planning on harming the guy, why doesn't he just say, well, guys, is it lawful to do good? Now, this is, to me, where the beauty of the nuance of the question comes in. Jesus says, is it lawful to do good or to do harm? Now, he asked that as an either or. If you come to a situation and you either have to do good or to do harm, which one's lawful? Well, obviously to do good. Now, here's where the nuance comes in. What if you see somebody that you could help and you don't? Is that doing harm? If there's somebody that you could help and you don't help them, by definition, aren't you actually doing them harm? Now we have a problem, right? Jesus has just created a dilemma for the Pharisees, because he has taken this circumstance and he's turned it upside down. And he said, look, here's the problem. You've presented me with this opportunity. Now I have to choose to help him or not help him. If I help him, I'm doing good on the Sabbath. But if I don't help him, I've done him harm on the Sabbath. Now, a lot of times, you know, people will read this story and go, well, why didn't Jesus just go up to the guy and say, hey, meet me tomorrow? I'll come back tomorrow. But the thing is, that's not the point. Because some circumstances don't lend themselves to wait till tomorrow, right? And so Jesus, in the way he phrases this question, sets up this beautiful dilemma, one which some of us probably should think more often about. When we see the opportunity to do good, and we choose not to because of the circumstance, well, somebody's watching, or this is a setup, or I don't want to deal with the stuff that goes with this, I'm just going to not do good. We are, by definition, doing what? We're doing harm. We're doing evil. Now, if you think I'm overstating that, we'll get to another verse. We'll get to another verse later that addresses that. So in this story, Jesus has come into the temple into the synagogue, and he's come in and he's got this circumstance, and the Pharisees are watching. And so we, as we said, the world is constantly watching us. The world is constantly watching. And we run into circumstances sometimes where we have to make a choice about how to react to a circumstance. And you know, it's interesting. We live in a world now where good and evil are hard to identify sometimes, right? Now, you guys know I abhor politics in church, and so I'm gonna use this as an example, not because I want this to become political. I don't want any comments from the congregation about the politics of this. If you want to talk about it, talk about it on the way home. Don't email me. Don't text me. I don't want to hear it. I had someone come up to me in 2016, and this is what they said to me. They said, Stuart, I don't know what to do. I either have to vote for a candidate whose platform I don't agree with, or I have to vote for a platform whose candidate I don't agree with. What do I do? I said, why are you asking me? Well, you're my preacher. I said, well, call your congressman. And in that moment, I sympathized. I sympathized with that. And you know, I guess the easy answer would have been, well, just go home. Don't vote for anybody. If you feel that way, just don't vote. But by not voting, you kind of are voting. So I said, look, here's what you need to do. You need to pray about this thing. I can't tell you who to vote for. That's not my job. I can't tell anybody who to vote for. That is not something I get paid to do. But my job is not to tell people how to vote. But I was sympathetic to the circumstance. There are circumstances in this life, as it has become more and more complicated, as we deal in a world where the veil between good and evil gets progressively thinner, at least by the definition of the world. And as Christians, we find ourselves caught in those circumstances all the time. And we hear these kind of platitudes where, like, love the sinner, hate the sin. Any of you ever found that to be a complicated thing to apply? Love the sinner, hate the sin. How do I deal with someone who's living a sinful life? How do I treat them without giving the appearance that I'm condoning what they do? Any of you ever heard that one? Well, if you're nice to that person, you're condoning what they're doing. I'm not condoning what they're doing, but the Lord tells me to love everybody, right? So I'm supposed to love this person, but I'm not supposed to like this person? How do I address that? And so we live in a world that's gotten progressively more complicated. And we say, well, you know, it's never been this complicated. But it is. Jesus walks into an incredibly complicated situation. Here's a guy, he needs to be healed. I want to heal him, but it's the Sabbath and they're watching me. So how do I deal in these circumstances? As I walk around in my daily life, how do I deal in these circumstances? Where and I one of the things that really bothers me about social media is the number of people who have on their social media account, they identify as Christian, and they say some of the meanest, ugliest stuff you've ever seen. And they feel justified because they're angry, but it's like, but people are reading that, and they're reading your profile, and they're going, this person's supposed to be a Christian. That didn't sound very... Any of you ever read anything online that you're like, that didn't sound very Christian? And the truth is, most people in this room have probably posted something that you went back later and went, righteous indignation, but, yeah. And so we live in this world where because of social media and because of video and because of everything else, it is more and more obvious what we say and what we do is being seen by other people. When Caleb's girlfriend came down to visit during Christmas break, she's from Tennessee. She's a big Tennessee fan. So I was picking on her about this story that had come out. There's this girl who, when she turned 15, she got her learner's permit, and as a joke, she sent a Snapchat to one of her friends, and she used a racial slur in the Snapchat. Now, the Snapchat was about 5 seconds long. I don't do Snapchat. My children have begged me not to be on Snapchat, and I have gleefully chosen not to be on Snapchat. So I'm not sure how Snapchat works, but she sent the message. Now, my understanding is for those of you Snapchatters in here, the message is supposed to last how long before it disappears? You can set it. You can set it? Okay. But here's the problem, and help me out if I'm wrong here. You guys help me out because I don't want to be wrong in a sermon because that makes me look bad. If somebody posts a Snapchat and sets it to disappear in 10 minutes, you can still save it, right? Yeah. Oh, okay, there you go. So this girl, as a joke, sent one of her friends a Snapchat that was not supposed to be on there long. The problem was someone else saw it and saved it. 4 years later, she is an incoming freshman at the University of Tennessee, and she has a, I don't know if it's a scholarship or how that stuff works, but she has an invitation to be on Tennessee's cheerleading team. She's a freshman, and she's going to be on Tennessee's cheerleading team. And some kid who had captured that chat, Snapchat, took it to the administration of the college. She was kicked off the cheerleading team for a 5-second clip that happened 4 years ago when she was 15. She was kicked off the team. The backlash on social media was so bad, she had to withdraw from college. She had to withdraw from college. You know why? Because for 5 seconds online, she said something stupid. And the fact that people were taking it out of context, not the point. It was on there forever. And she, you know, she could even argue, well, the person I sent it to gave me permission to use. Doesn't matter. I used to tell Caleb and Sam that. If your friends tell you it's okay to say something, that doesn't mean their friends think it's okay. And if somebody tapes it, it's with you for life. That's the world we live in. That's the world we live in now. And so our behavior is probably more significant now than at any time in history because people are constantly watching us and remembering who we are and what we represent. And they could pull up and say, you remember when you did this? I love that Facebook reminds me of that every once in a while. I'll be sitting there and I'll go on Facebook and they'll say, do you remember this memory when you said this 8 years ago? And I'm like, I remember that. And every once in a while I go, oh, did I say that? That ever happened to any of you? Any of you ever had one of those memories pop up? You're like, oh. You know.
It reminds me how funny I am.
It means, only Doug would say that. Yeah, I'm a pretty funny guy. You know, this is the dilemma of the world we live in. And so as Christians, we have to be increasingly aware of our footprint. We have to be increasingly aware of the representation that we are creating of God. Because as a people who identify as his people, what we say and do gets connected to him. Right? When I was a kid growing up, I tried not to get in a lot of trouble. Come on, Jim. I tried not to get in a lot of trouble. Now, the reason I tried not to get in a lot of trouble is not because I had friends who didn't get in a lot of trouble. It's because I understood intricately, if I got in trouble, guess who it reflected on? My dad. And it really didn't even reflect on mom. It reflected on dad because dad was a preacher. And so I knew preacher's kids who got in trouble, and I really didn't. Well, it was a couple reasons. Number one, because I was a wonderful son. Number two, I didn't want to get beat when I got home. So there was a dual role in me trying not to get in trouble. When we do things, when we make decisions in this world, those decisions, whether intentionally or not, those decisions reflect on God. They reflect on Christ because we identify as his people, and so the things we do and say reflect on him. And you say, well, that's not my intention, but it doesn't matter the intention. How many people have suffered in this cancel culture because of a decision they made that the context didn't matter at all? Didn't matter at all. And so when we look at this text and we see Jesus come into this situation, he knows people are watching him, and he says, hey, look, here's the question I really want to ask you guys. Is it okay to do good, or is it okay to do evil? You know, can I help? Can I harm? Which one? And I think they recognize where he was going, so they just didn't say anything. All right, next verse. Verse 5, please. It says, after looking around at them, this is with anger. So any of you ever thinks Jesus never got angry? There it is right there. After looking around at them with anger, he was angry at their attitude because they were using this poor guy whose hand was crippled. They were using him as a tool to get Jesus. And so he's angry. He says, looking around them with anger, he was grieved at their hardness of heart. And you look around the world today and you're like, any of you ever see anything in the world that makes you angry? All you got, if you turn on the TV, if you watch the news, if you get on social media, if you walk out your front door, there's a good chance that there's something that you're going to see that irritates you, that agitates you, that makes you angry about the world we live in. And that's okay. Jesus is angry when he looks at these Pharisees. And I've often thought the greatest example of Jesus' perfection was his ability to not kill those people. To have the ability to just snap your finger and watch all of them just on the floor. They were so awful. And they're watching him, and they've kind of set him up, and he looks around at him. It says he looks at him with anger. He was grieved at their hardness of heart. And so you think about how this works, and it's like some of you say, well, Stuart, you just don't understand. I get so angry. Well, Jesus got angry, and we know that. Scripture tells us he was angry. By the way, is this the only time Jesus ever got angry? No, not hardly. And so, but he was frustrated because he saw in these people their pettiness. And I mean, you think about this. If you're a Pharisee and you see Jesus walk up to this guy who's, and his hand was withered, which means this was a visible injury. To imagine that Jesus could walk up and just try to imagine how this would look. Jesus walks up and touches this guy, and the hand just starts to open. It just starts to change right in front of your eyes. And he does, just imagine that happening, and the Pharisees, instead of rejoicing and praising God because God had sent a Savior who could do these amazing things, they become even more determined to kill him. I mean, it makes no sense. It makes no sense. So it's not hard to understand why Jesus would be so frustrated and so angry with them. It says, he looked around at him with anger. He was grieved at their hardness of heart. And he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And so he stretched it out, and his hand was restored. Doesn't say how Jesus did it. Doesn't matter. Jesus restored the guy's hand. In that moment, Jesus had put this dilemma on the Pharisees. I can help him, which is good, or I could not help him, which would be harmful. And so, since you guys won't tell me which is okay, I'm gonna help him. The reason I think this text is really important is because I think as a people, we have convinced ourselves that not getting involved is our out. That's our out. When we see a circumstance where we could either do something or not do something, and we convince ourselves, well, you know what? By not getting involved, that's okay. By choosing not to help, that's okay. That way, I don't get involved. I haven't hurt anybody, but I'm not getting involved. And in this story, Jesus says that's not how this works. When we get confronted with an opportunity, and we choose not to be helpful, we choose not to love someone and get involved, we are, in fact, by definition, doing harm to that person. Now, that doesn't apply to every circumstance. I think there has to be some understanding, some discernment as you see that. Obviously, you know, it's like if somebody who's going to spend the money you give them on drugs comes up and says, hey, can you give me $10? You're not helping them giving them $10 if they're going to use that money for drugs. So I think you do have to have some discernment in how this works. But generally speaking, when we see people, especially when we see people in the church who are struggling and need help, and that isn't just financial. That can be spiritual. It can be emotional. It could just be, hey, you need somebody to talk to. When we choose, you know what, I just want to get out here and get lunch. I don't have time to deal with this person's drama today. How many of you have ever known someone who committed suicide? And after that person's death, friends lamented that that person never had anyone to talk to. Have you ever heard that happen? Man, didn't have anybody to talk to. And you think, well, what do you mean they didn't have anybody to talk to? How many of you have ever had somebody who wanted to talk to you and you just didn't have time? You just didn't have time. You're busy. Because we're busy people, right? We got a lot of stuff going on. Oh, I'll talk to you later. I'll get with you later. I remember one year we were at camp. And we have a very busy schedule at camp. And this is maybe my third or fourth year I'd been a dean. And so I take being a dean very seriously. We have a busy schedule, got a lot of stuff going on. And this kid comes up to me and says, hey, can I talk to you about getting baptized? And I went, not right now. We got some stuff going on. I'll get with you later. And one of my staff came up to me, who saw that, came up to me and said, dude, why are you here? Dude, you just had a kid say you want to get baptized, and you didn't have time to do it because you had stuff on your schedule. By the way, that was one of the most embarrassing things that's ever happened to me in my life. Having one of my staff have to call me out because I was too busy with recreation schedule to talk to a kid who wanted to get baptized. And that was the last time that happened. And now when we have camp, I tell them every time, if a kid comes to you and wants to talk about getting baptized, you stop everything else you're doing. You let somebody know, hey, I got something to do. I got this thing I got to deal with. Cover for me. You do not put a kid off who wants to do that. You know, we don't do that. But the thing was, it made perfect sense for me to tell that kid I'll get with you later because I was busy. I was busy. And so there's an incredible lesson in this story for us about how when we sometimes choose not to do good, we actually might do harm. What if that kid had gone back to the dorm that night, not come and talk to me later, and ended up never becoming a Christian? Guess who that would have been on? Partially, it would have been on me. Now, you could argue, well, you know, if they were really serious, they would have talked to somebody else. But that's not the point. In that moment, my decision might have actually caused permanent harm to that person. And you say, well, Stuart, I don't know how you think about it. And so Jesus, when he now has established for the Pharisees, look, in this moment, in this situation, now I have to make a choice, and I either choose to do good, or if I do nothing, I am by definition choosing to do harm. And so here's what I'm going to do. After I've posed this question to you guys and you don't have an answer, I'm going to heal them. Now listen to the response. He said, stretch out your hand, and he stretched it out, and his hand was restored. And then the Pharisees went out and immediately began conspiring with the Herodians against him as to how they might destroy him. Jesus heals this guy, and they're like, we're gonna destroy you. Any of you ever experienced a circumstance where no matter what you did, it didn't make people happy? Yeah, said, nothing you did was right. Nothing you did was enough. You just do this, and it's like they're still mad. You know what I've learned about people? This is something I had to learn as a minister so that I didn't lose my mind. If people want to find fault with you, guess what they're going to do? They're going to find fault with you. Because, trust me, I'm dumb enough, I'm going to give you a reason sooner or later. If you want to be mad at me, I will give you a reason. It's not intentional, it's just reality. And isn't that true of everybody? If you want to dislike somebody, won't they give you a reason eventually? Here's the funny thing. If you want to love people, what are you going to do? You're going to love them. You know what? And you know what? You're going to love them in spite of their flaws, right? When you don't want to like somebody, you'll find a reason not to. If you want to love somebody, you'll find a reason to love them. That's just the way we are. There are people in this world. The scripture tells us there are people in this world that are going to despise you because of your relationship with Christ. They're going to despise you for it. And we get mad when we do what we feel like is the right thing, and they get angry. Guess what? They're going to get angry no matter what you do. They're going to get madder when you. They're going to get mad when you don't help somebody. They're going to get mad when you do help somebody. Because it doesn't matter what you do. They're going to be angry. And that's the Pharisees, and that's how they treated Jesus, and that's how a sinful world is going to treat the church. They're going to hate. People who want to hate Christians are going to hate us no matter what we do. So here's a suggestion. Stop worrying about what they think. We live in an era today where the church is so worried about what the world thinks of us. We have churches who are changing their doctrine so that the world won't be mad at them. That's the world we live in now. Oh, well, we don't want to offend anybody. We don't want to upset anybody. Can you imagine Jesus walking around doing his ministry, not wanting to upset anybody? This guy with a withered hand. Jesus, my hand, look at it, it's terrible. Can you heal it? Yeah, I can heal it. Oh, thank you. I'm not going to. Why not? Why not? I don't want to make them mad. Dude, they hate you already. Yeah, I don't want to give them more reason. But they're going to hate you if you don't heal me. I can't do it. I'm sorry. I don't want to give them a reason. I don't want to make them mad. I really want everybody to like me. By the way, do any of you ever think Jesus spent a lot of time worrying about who liked him? In fact, every time Jesus accumulated a big crowd in his ministry, you know what he would do? He would teach something hard and run most of them off. He would run, you know, he feeds the 5,000, you know, and he's got this big crowd, and then he talks about, you know, the bread of life. If you want to partake of my body and my blood, and they're like, oh, this is a hard teaching, and they all went away. After all the people he healed, after all the preaching he did, on the day of Pentecost, how many people were up in that room? Like 200? He had 200 followers after 3 years of healing people and doing all the stuff he did? Yeah, I mean, We worry so much about offending people who already hate us. Their worldview and our worldview are not the same, and we're trying to appease them, and sometimes we're doing that by refusing to do what's right. And when we refuse to do what's right, by definition, we then are doing what is harmful. I want to close this morning with a passage from James chapter 4, verse 17. This is James, the brother of Jesus, and he says this at the end of chapter 4. He says, therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is what? It is sin. When you know the right thing to do, when you understand biblically, this is the right thing. But you know what? I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it, and I got 1,000 good reasons I'm not going to do it. But ultimately, this is what it comes down to. When we know the right thing and we choose not to do it, it's a sin. And you think about the world we live in and all the things that are going on and the times that we are confronted with an opportunity to do what is right, and we convinced ourselves that not doing anything is an option and it doesn't matter. James says, no, that's not how it works. Imagine you're driving home one night in your neighborhood, and as you're driving to your house, you see a fire in somebody's living room through the window. And you don't see any lights or any movement, and you don't, you know, these people might be asleep. They might not even know. And you just drive on by and go home. And you, because you just assumed, oh, they probably know. They're probably out of the house. Maybe they're not even home. So you don't stop because it's not my problem, not my business. And then the next day you find out that everybody in that house died in that fire. How many of you would feel guilty? You know why you'd feel guilty? Because you could have saved them, and you didn't even bother to try. And you might have 100 good excuses why you shouldn't. You know what? First of all, I don't even like those people. Those people kicked my cat once. My cat was in their yard, and those people kicked my cat. They don't like me. Those people never wave at me when I drive by. I'll wave at them, and they just go, you know, they don't even wave at. They're not even really nice people. They have parties, and they have music, and the music's loud, keeps me awake. I just don't like the way they look. Their kids are irritating. You might have 100 good reasons, but the truth is, none of those reasons justify driving by and leaving those people to die in a fire. And you would know that. And I guess most of you sitting there going, Stuart, what a ridiculous analogy. All right, let's try this one. What if you had an opportunity to keep somebody out of eternal fire, but you were too busy to stop and try to get them out? Some of you are going, oh, you planned that. I did plan that. Some of you are sitting there going, oh, Stuart, that was good. You're right, it was. It was amazing. That's, you know, we all would go, oh, Stuart, if I left somebody in a house to burn to death, I'd feel so awful. I'd feel so guilty. Can you imagine what it would be like to stand there on Judgment Day and see people that you knew, that you were friends with, that you had a relationship with, who were being sent off into eternal torment because you never had the time? You were too busy on your way home. You didn't have time to stop and talk to them. And you were like, well, Stuart, and then you start making these excuses, right? Well, they wouldn't have listened anyway. They weren't going to listen to me. They weren't going to listen to me. And you stand there and you try to make all these excuses in your head, but the reality is the minute you see God say, depart from me because I don't know you, and they, as they're walking away, they turn and they look at you, and they're like, why didn't you tell me? You're going to look at him and go, because you wouldn't listen anyway. Is that what we're prepared to do on Judgment Day? Is that what we're going to do? James says, when we know the right thing to do, when we know it, and we choose not to do it, it's a sin that's on us. We call these sins of omission, but they're still sin. I want to challenge you today, as the praise team comes up to lead us in our communion hymn, I want to challenge you to understand the world you live in and the reality that there are constantly people watching. And every time we make a decision, every time we do something, we are influencing people one way or another, whether we intend to or not. Because we live in a world that's constantly watching. And when we are confronted with those opportunities and we're confronted with an option like Jesus was, here's the weathered guy, I got to do something. I'm either going to help him or by not helping him, I'm going to harm him. And you could argue, well, if you don't help him, nothing's changed. But something has changed. Because by Jesus' very entrance into that room, the opportunity for healing was there. And Jesus understood that. And that's what he wanted the Pharisees to understand. And that's what he wants you to understand. When he puts people in your path that you have an opportunity to help, by not helping them, by not sharing Christ with them, you by definition harm them. And if that's an inconvenient truth for us, well, that's okay. Scripture's full of inconveniences, isn't it? James says, therefore the one who does not do the right thing, to him it is sin. I want to challenge you to keep your eyes open this week for opportunities to do the right thing. And to recognize that people are watching and understand that decisions you make are making an impact. And it may not be a huge impact, but it's an impact nonetheless. And the only impact is not on them. There is an impact on us. Because when we choose to not do that which is right, to us it is sin.